with any kind of employment-related problem, and we provide legal assistance. We also do advocacy. We help to lead the Oregon Coalition to stop wage theft and a variety of things like that.
And so, of course, it makes me wonder, well, we have a state labor commissioner, right? He would never let anything like this happen in Oregon. Where is he?
Well, a problem is that the state labor commissioner has a budget. And the budget is funded by a legislature that is strapped for funds. And so while the folks at, we call it BOLI, or the Bureau of Labor and Industries, the folks at BOLI do what they can, I think, with the resources they have, inevitably there are lots of people around the state who can't get access to a BOLI office, may not know that BOLI exists, and in any event, there aren't sufficient resources there to meet the problem.
And may be fearful of going to a government office.
This is also sometimes a problem.
Mm-hmm. And so, let me go back to my other question. Becky,
sure.
Is that what you like?
Yep.
Okay.
You've known me for 5 minutes, so now you can call me Becky.
Okay.
That's the rule.
Well, you introduced yourself that way when you met me, so I wanted to be respectful and make sure that I was using a name you were comfortable with. Well, Becky, now that we're friends, you've been visiting legislators in Oregon, and first, what's your message to the legislature, and second, how responsive have they been?
So we did a legislative briefing yesterday that actually Michael's organization put together, and then we are doing another legislative briefing today. And our message is really that, one, wage theft is real. Two, wage theft is serious, and it's related to rising inequality in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Because workers who don't have money to spend and are already in low-wage jobs are really in trouble when their wages are stolen. And three, that Oregon should get on board. There are about half the states, there's been some kind of action in the last 4 years around wage theft and the misclassification of workers, calling them independent contractors, saying, hey, buddy, you're in business for yourself, although you work for me and I tell you exactly what to do and where to go and when to do it.
Right.
So the states are really moving on wage theft, and we think Oregon can be a leader.
And so I'm curious if I'm curious as to how employers can actually get away with wage theft, right? I mean, we have, you know, minimum wage laws, we have hour limits to how workers can work, how long a worker can work. How is it that employers can get away with this?
A lot of brass is one thing, but let's say I have 100 workers and I'm an unscrupulous employer. I don't want to pay the minimum wage.
Right.
Out of those 100 workers, I can pocket a part of the pay of all 100. Now, many of them will be afraid. Many of them will be worried about their jobs. Many of them will not know where to go or what to do. Let's say 10 ultimately complain. And it goes into an administrative process, let's say at BOLI. And weeks and months pass, and finally at the end of the day, let's say they prevail. And the employer then has to pay what should have been paid on payday. So essentially, if I'm that employer, I get to keep all the money of the people who never complain.
Right.
And from the ones who do, I get an interest-free loan for 6 months and only have to turn around and pay back. And we haven't been successful enough at making it extremely costly and painful for those who do get caught as a disincentive for people exploiting workers.
Right. And that takes me back again to BOLI, right? The Bureau of Labor and Industry, because that's their job, right? Their job is to be the advocate and to bring the hammer down when they find employers acting inappropriately.
Well, I don't want to be overly critical of BOLI, because you can do what you can do with the resources that are provided by the public. But, you know, in the last biennium, they got cut back to the point where at one point they could not accept about half of the kinds of claims that come in, even to process them, because they had lost investigators to the point where, I mean, there was no point. There was nothing they could do with the claims.
Right.
I don't blame Bowley or the commissioner for that. In fact, I credit the commissioner for aggressive advocacy to get those resources back.
Right.
But he needs a lot more resources to be able to address this problem. That's part of the problem. And then there are some structural things in the employment economy that make it difficult to collect wages. One example is that in the new economy, lots of people are using what we call labor intermediaries. By that, what I mean is someone that's put in between the real boss
right.
and the worker, and that person is treated as being the employer of the workers. The workers then try to get paid by that person. Maybe that person doesn't have any money. Maybe that person disappears and go to the real employer for accountability. The real employer says, who are you? I don't know you. You weren't my employee.
Right.
I already paid that guy over there.
Mm-hmm.
And because of those structural difficulties, some confusion in the way that the word employ is mm-hmm. defined in right. the wage statutes, it makes it kind of difficult. Another kind of problem similar to that is the difficulty in actually collecting a judgment once you establish.
Win one.
Yeah, that also is a problem because of the way that people hide assets, tie assets, use corporate structures to manipulate their assets. And we need to do some work there also to make whoever's enforcing the wage obligations able to collect, whether that's the worker themselves through mm-hmm. a private attorney or through Bowley.
Thank you. For listeners, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. I'm talking to Rebecca Smith, Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, and Michael Dale, who is a attorney with the Northwest Workers Justice Project. So I want to go back to you, Becky, and see if you'll answer the question that I asked earlier. Is this a problem that's primarily low-income workers, or is this a problem that's kind of across the economic spectrum?
It's a problem that's across the economic spectrum. You see, you know, wage and hour lawsuits being filed by workers in pretty much every walk of life. My organization is mostly concerned about low-wage workers because the effect of wage theft is so much more dire on folks who are earning, you know, $20,000 a year. And, you know, we're finding that people are losing about 15% of their income to wage theft.
Wow.
And these are folks who need that money.
That are on the edge anyway.
Folks who are on the edge anyway. The other piece is that by and large, folks who are earning more money also have better access to lawyers. They know where to go to complain for violations of their minimum wage, overtime, for wage theft. And so I suspect that people who are suffering wage theft who are much more comfortable are also having some better luck with getting their money back.
And so I want to go back to my other question. So you've been briefing legislators on the issue. Are there specific legislative proposals that are coming to this legislative or to the legislators?
We had, when I say we, I'm talking about the Coalition to Stop Wage Theft. We had six different bills that were in the last session of the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
One of them passed.
Mm-hmm.
We have those proposals that are sort of have been vetted and are in discussion. In this session of the legislature, because it's a short session
mm-hmm.
and it's sort of geared to deal with the budget and
mm-hmm.
things that people can agree upon easily, this is not an easy kind of proposition. So we didn't put them before the legislature this time. We're looking more toward 2015 when we have a full session. Mm-hmm. But we did want to be sure that legislators were hearing about the problem and hearing about potential solutions, and that the issue just didn't go off their radar. And that's why we spent this week doing a variety of activities, including a lobby day on Monday, to raise the issue of wage theft.
Wonderful. We have a caller on the line. Good morning, Joanne. Welcome to KBOO.
Yeah. Criminals, are they usually old small businesses or new small businesses or what? I'll listen off the air.
Great question. Thanks for the call.
Who wants to answer that?
Yes.
So all of the above.
All of the above, including well-established large corporations. Mm-hmm. It just is pretty much across the board.
Wow.
One thing that you asked before, I do think it's more heavily concentrated in lower wage industries. Although I certainly agree with Becky's comment, but didn't you do some work about the relationship between low wage and the occurrence of wage theft?
Yes. We looked at low wage industries and how frequent people in low wage industries suffer wage theft. And certainly, and I can't tell you the statistics off the top of my head, but waiters and waitresses, off-the-clock violations, mm-hmm. pervasive. Mm-hmm. People who are delivering home health care, mm-hmm. also pervasive. People who are working in janitorial or construction and on and on. And those statistics are also pretty high. Our study focused on low-wage workers, mm-hmm. but virtually across those industries, every single occupation suffered pretty alarming rates of wage theft.
And so how does this impact immigrant communities?
We're looking at each other.
Well, immigrant workers tend to be newer to the economy, and because they're newer to the economy, they tend to be in lower paying, more vulnerable, entry level kinds of jobs. Mm-hmm. They're more exploitable. They're less likely to know what to do and where to go and how to get it taken care of. And so it does profoundly impact immigrant communities. The fear of making waves or causing trouble or going to the government. Many of our immigrant clients come from countries where
that's not where you go for help.
the policeman is not your friend. And so to go into a government office is pretty overwhelming for folks.
Mm. We have another caller on the line. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, Michael. Welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, hello.
Good morning.
I got a question. When you said that you find wage theft across the board, would you say it's less likely with people that work off contracts versus people that work off applications? Because I think that fall victim to wage theft is people that work under the at-will philosophy versus people that have contracts, and you got to fulfill those contracts. And my last question is that when I had issues with my money from a contractor, I didn't go to Boley. I went to Salem to the person that gave them their license and complained.
And they
gave me instructions on what I should do to get paid. So I just wanted to throw that out. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the call, Michael.
Are you a construction worker?
He's gone, but yes.
Oh, he's gone. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Well, let me say a couple of things about that. When he says people that are at will, I think what he's getting at is this. More and more in our economy, particularly after the recession, as jobs are being replaced, it tends to be less a full-time job with a union contract, with a funded pension that you work for 40 years, work a little overtime, send the kids to school, and get a gold watch when you're 55. It's not that kind of a thing. It's what we call contingent work. And by contingent work, basically a contingent worker is anybody who's working their butt off, but they don't really have a job.
Mm-hmm.
They may be standing on the street corner to get hired. They may be working for a temp agency. They may be working on a temporary assignment. Mm-hmm. They may be treated as an independent contractor when they really aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And the growth of contingent work in our economy coincides or goes right along with exploitation, because a contingent worker by very definition doesn't have a lot of a toehold in the workplace, and so that makes them more vulnerable and therefore more exploitable. Well, I suspect that Michael was a construction worker, and one of the things that we've been able to do over the last several years is work with the Construction Contractors Board, who licenses construction contractors to make continued licensing contingent upon taking care of wage liabilities. And that's been a successful effort over the last couple of years.
Good. I know one of the problems in the construction industry is that if you're a subcontractor, especially if you're a small subcontractor, the big contractor can take their time paying you. They may have gotten the money, but they're getting the interest and they're taking their time. So if you're a big company, waiting 30 days for payment is not a big deal. If you're a tiny company, waiting 30 days to get that money in becomes a huge deal. And so there, I think some of those challenges may be what Michael was alluding to as well.
These are problems that are particular to the construction industry. The other thing what we've seen is that we used to see people in agriculture who were what we called farm labor contractors. They still exist in agriculture, but that's where the idea originated, where the person's function was is just to round up bodies, workers, and take them to a farm.
Mm-hmm.
What we've started to see in the construction industry is a similar kind of pattern where actually even some of the same individuals, some of whom had lost their licensing to be a farm labor contractor, began taking people to construction sites instead. Mm-hmm. And that kind of person actually is covered by the new law that we did get passed. It's not in effect yet, because they have to write regulations and inform everybody of what their duties are, so it won't go into effect until July 1 of 2015. But basically what it will require is that kind of person to be licensed and bonded, and it will require construction contractors, if they're going to use a labor broker to recruit workers, to make sure that they're using somebody who's licensed with a bond, and that should help improve that problem.
Wonderful. Again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Smith, who's Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, and Michael Dale, who's an attorney with the Northwest Workers Justice Project. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. We have a caller on the line. Hello, David. Welcome to KBOO. Hello, David. Are you there?
Mm-hmm.
I think
can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can hear you now. Good morning.
Okay, great. Good morning. Thank you for this wonderful conversation. You actually stole one of my questions, so I'll ask a different question.
Sorry, I tend to do that.
You know, we're on the same wavelength. So I wanted to see whether or not there was any indication that this wage theft is disproportionately experienced by people of color. I know that the immigration question came up, but I'm interested because I do have two young men in the workforce, and I'm wondering how prevalent that is for people of color, and I'll take my answer off here.
Thank you for the question.
When we did our study, we found, of course, that wage theft is prevalent everywhere, and that it's sort of an equal opportunity crime. But we did find that especially young women of color, and of course, especially immigrants, were vulnerable to wage theft. So yes, there is that element.
Any data for Oregon?
I don't have data, but what I can say is that wage theft is a crime of opportunity, and the opportunity has to do with the worker's vulnerability, and to the extent that it's more difficult for someone to find another job than willingness to accept maybe a little less in the paycheck and not make problems waves. Or make waves is a little greater. And in our experience, though I can't cite statistics, we find that more frequently impacts communities of color.
Can you tell me, what do you think the percentage of people who are experiencing wage theft that make their way to your office?
Tip of the iceberg.
Tip of the iceberg.
I think the most common outcome of wage theft is the employer keeps the money and the worker doesn't get paid. That's sadly, I think that's probably the case.
Okay, it sounds like those other five bills are going to have to get passed to fix that. And we'll get back to those five bills. We have a caller on the line. Hello, Marion. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi. Yeah, this is a little bit of a side issue, and it's not as bad as a lot of the stuff that goes on. But the Art Institute of Portland, here in Portland, I worked there for a while, actually for about 8 years, as a part-time temporary employee. And when their system, so you have to enter your hours in the computer system, which is a bad system. It's always breaking down. And also it tends to expire passwords and not have that. You know, to get a new password, you have to go through your supervisor. Anyway, if somebody can't get their hours in by the deadline, you know, they end up not getting paid until the following. You can't put your hours in until the following pay period. Your paycheck gets delayed by 2 weeks. This is illegal. And I filed a complaint about, because what they need to do, if the computer system's not working, that's no excuse for not paying somebody on time.
Right.
You need to fill out a paper timesheet, you know, get it signed. I don't care if somebody has to sit down and write out a paycheck by hand. You know, you pay that employee when it's due.
Exactly.
And I complained about this. They didn't do anything. So I filed a complaint with Bully. And, yeah, I heard back from Bully that they accepted the complaint, but nothing was ever done because, like you said, they're overworked. I even wrote to the Education Management Association. They're headquartered in Philadelphia. They own all these art institutes. They've been going on buying up art schools all over the country for years, corporatizing them. And I did hear back from their legal department. They were worried. They called me in person. But anyway, for myself, I didn't let this happen. I took a screen print of their timesheet, printed it out, filled it out by hand, took it to my supervisor. But, you know, most of the people there are like student workers. They're young people. They don't know what their rights are.
Right.
And they probably just put up with this.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate you calling with a real-life experience. And so what was the outcome?
Well, I always get paid on time. I don't know. I don't think anything was done. I think this is still going on here.
Let me draw out two things from your story. One is, isn't it interesting that I believe you said that you worked 5 years?
8 years,
actually. 8 years as a temp.
Was it 8 years?
Well, I was an art model. I mean, it's a temporary, irregular job anyway.
8 years.
For 8 years.
Yeah.
You were a temporary employee for eight years.
Right.
Temporary.
Right.
We call that situation a permatemp.
Right, well, exactly.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, too many of the jobs in our economy are devolving in that direction, and it gives people less security. You obviously were undeterred, so more power to you.
Oh, I mean, it's just one thing that I did.
The other point I wanted to make out, draw out of your story is, when there's a problem with the timekeeping, when there's a problem with the whatever system the company uses to record what you're entitled to, that's the company's problem. That's not the employee's problem.
Right. Yeah.
It is the company's legal responsibility to maintain a system. And if it ain't working, they've got to figure out how to make it work. And it should not be on the employee to have to deal with that. Now, if it's not getting done, of course, I would encourage employees to do it. But I just wanted to make that point that, it sounds like as if if it doesn't work, that's your problem. No,
that
it's
was
not.
Their attitude. Yeah, exactly.
Right, so I just won't eat for 2 weeks because
And the other thing that I'd like to add too, Marion, there are so many pieces of your story is, excuse me, that you were able to fix it for yourself, mm-hmm. but I'm guessing that that practice continued for everyone else. Mm-hmm. Because often when complaints are made by one person, agencies are so overworked that they're only looking at what that one person experienced, even though it's very clear that it's a practice that affects everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your call, Marion.
Yeah, thanks for having the show.
You're welcome. Okay, have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. I am speaking with Rebecca Smith, who's the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project, and Michael Dale, who's a attorney with the Northwest Workers Justice Project. And so for me, it becomes obvious that as unions go away, as collective bargaining by employees go away, wage theft is on the increase. Mm. Is that just me or?
No, that's absolutely right. When folks have a union in their workplace, that's usually the first line of defense, right? Mm-hmm. And the union can operate as a check on whatever it is that the employer is doing. And so I think that's a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And yes, unions are declining so much. If you look at sort of a graph of the rise of the middle class, it goes right along with the rise of unions,
that's
and
right.
the decline goes
right along
as well.
It's true. It's absolutely true. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. And so let's talk a little bit about the bills that you're going to submit next legislative session that didn't make it through this session. The last session.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a coalition process,
okay.
And we have not yet determined what bills exactly we're going to put forward.
Okay.
And so I'm happy to talk about some of the ideas, but with it understood that I'm not doing it on behalf of the coalition.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the coalition. Who's in the coalition?
The coalition is 36 organizations. It includes important labor, faith-based, immigrant-based and community organizations, advocacy organizations. It is growing, involves. Do you want me to list out some of the participants in the coalition?
I was just kind of curious about the kind of organizations that are involved. So no, I think you've done a good job of actually just giving us some highlight. It's always good to have, as a former legislator, I know how good it is to have a coalition that's going in to talk mm-hmm. to legislators. And before the program's over, I'm going to ask you what our listening audience can do as we prepare for the 2015 legislative session, because you know there's an election coming up and people are going to be talking to their legislators, and so it's important that we have good information to share with them. But we have several callers on the line now, and we're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Angie. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question. I was hired on as a temporary in December.
Mm-hmm.
And in January, they decided that they liked what I did. And so we had a verbal agreement to go permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And then halfway through January, they decided that since I hadn't signed a contract, that I would go back to being temporary. And so now I am reaching the point where I would have been at my 3-month mark.
So you would have been getting health care.
Yes.
You'd have some benefits and you'd have some stability, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm just kind of in this limbo and there's really no answer as to the continued duration of my temporariness.
And
it's just kind of.
So have you asked kind of like how long is temporary going to be?
I did. I emailed our HR person, and the response was, "I'll get back to you." And since then, I have heard from them nothing.
So temporary status is going to last until I get back to you.
Right. And that's the human resource person, right? So the person is supposed to know. So what do you suggest this worker do?
Angie, are you in a work site that's organized? That has a union contract?
No, not that organized.
Okay. I don't have very good news for you. Basically, you're in what's called at-will employment. And at-will means that there's freedom of contract. The employer's free to give you work or not. And you're free to starve or not. And unfortunately, that's the situation unless you have a collective bargaining contract or interpersonal contract that commits the employer for a certain period of time.
So how many employees are in your place?
There are 8 total. Mm-hmm.
And how many of them are temporary employees?
I believe just me and one other.
And so you're the newest into the workplace?
Second newest.
Second newest. And the other temp employee is newer than you?
Yes.
And so it appears that since the economic downturn, your employer has learned that it is better not to make a commitment to their employee, but just simply bring them in with the promise of permanent employment and then renege on that promise when they feel like it.
Yes.
That sounds...
And that's what's happening all across the country. Temporary employment goes way down during recessions and then way up at the end of recessions. And, you know, we're waiting to see whether employers continue to string people along as we go in further into the recovery. But yeah, it may be small comfort, but there's millions of people that are in this kind of situation right now.
So here's one thing. I think one of the things that I would suggest to Angie or to anybody listening is if your employer tells you you're going to go from temp to permanent, get it in writing.
That's right.
That would be the first thing that people can learn from Angie's story. I think the second thing that I would tell Angie is, Angie, you're still working there?
Yes.
Is to start documenting all the conversations and all the efforts that you have taken to get get your rightful place within this company. And so that I would tell you to start doing right away and go back to the day you were hired and remember the dates, remember witnesses, remember conversations, and start keeping a diary, because at some point, if your employer doesn't do the right thing, you will have enough evidence that you've collected over the months that you can then take to Michael Dale.
Are we going to discuss his website or phone number?
We are going to do that. And at the end of the program, later today, all that will be posted on Voices from the Edge Facebook page and the website.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Angie. I really appreciate you calling, because there's nothing like talking to real people who are having real experiences with this, because sometimes we can get into the philosophical. Good luck with you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.
So did I give good advice?
You did.
Good.
That's always the advice for, I think, any worker, and I hope people are listening, is to document everything. Document the hours that you're working if you're being shorted. Think about who was there when a promise was made to you.
Okay, good. I'm not a lawyer, but I played one in a legislative body for 3 terms. So
and you are doing a heck of a job.
Well, thank you. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Garrett, welcome to KBOO. How are you?
I'm fine. I've actually got something to say about every time I've applied for a job, I've known that I'm not going to get it as soon as I know that there's a personality test. And as an ASPE, I always fail those. I think actually it should be considered discrimination, because as an ASPE, I know that there are only a couple personality types that I'll fit into, and they're always identifiable as the type of personality that will file a bully complaint or will cause trouble if I feel that I've been wronged. And I think that these personality tests that are being used are used to weed out the types of people who will stand up for their rights.
Sounds like it.
For this and a lot of other reasons, I've actually felt that the only way someone should be allowed to hire an employee is through the state employment agency, or even to the extent that the state is the only employer and you hire or you buy worker hours from the state, and you pay the state and the state pays the employee. That way there is a buffer to guarantee that no one will ever be cheated and that no one will ever be discriminated against. And if a corporation like Walmart decides that, you know, they like abusing their employers and they fired yet another employee for a wrongful reason, well, the state can just say, okay, well, you keep abusing our people, so we're not going to send any more to you.
Boy, that does sound like an interesting system to have in place. I don't know that I'd want the state to be the only employer, but I when I think about what, let's just
perhaps
say,
abusive employers.
Well, I hear where you're coming from. I mean, you started off talking about these tests that you have to take, and I saw heads in the studio nodding that. That sounds like something that you guys have heard before, yes?
Where do you get a job if you're over 50?
Well, that's another, that's a whole program by itself, right? Because you're right, as soon as they, no employer in this economy really wants to hire a 50-plus-year-old because they don't want to have to pay for the experience that you have. They'd much rather hire a 20-something-year-old that has no experience, and that way they can train them and pay them significantly less money. But that's and that is illegal. However, not many 50-year-olds actually get hired. So that's a really good question, and I'll let my guests answer
that. Without necessarily commenting on your particular example, because I don't know enough about it, really, but It strikes me that it raises two possible legal issues, the example that you gave. Possibly, if it's true that a commonly used personality test unfairly weeds out folks with a particular disability, then that would perhaps violate the Americans with Disability Act. And I have a resource for you.
I hate
to,
that word.
Well, that's the name of the law. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right.
I understand.
Which is why we call it ADA, right?
Right.
There you go.
There is an organization called Disability Rights Oregon that might want to look into it. This is kind of their area of specialization. The other thing you...
Go ahead.
Sorry, most ASPEs are not disabled, though. We have a personality type that is identifiable, but we don't actually have anything that qualifies as a disability. It's just a particular diagnosis. But
we understand. I think we certainly understand that. But the point is that the protections that you have come under this ADA law.
And I would say that. What the statute says is you have a disability or are regarded as having a disability. Mm-hmm. So if someone thinks that the personality type is one that disqualifies you for the job, even though it's not disabling, it may be considered by the employer as a disabling condition, and that might provide some relief. The other thing I did want to be sure and mention is that under Oregon law, if you're over 18, and under federal law, if you're over 40, it is against the law to discriminate against a worker on the basis of age. And of course,
how do you prove that?
Well, it was on the tip of my tongue to say this isn't always easy to prove, right. But for for listeners out there who may be facing this in their workplace, you know, you look at what the company does, not solely in your case, but also in the cases of other older workers, and try to pull together a case that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that would be really hard to do if you're applying for jobs, because mm-hmm. how do you know what the workplace is like? You don't know. I mean, they'll give you some bogus excuse about, you know, thank you for applying, but we found someone more right. suited to our needs, right? So you just go away thinking, okay, out of the 1,000 people who applied, I just wasn't the one.
Certainly with well-counseled, well-trained employers, that's what you get, and it's very, very difficult to prove. But you'd be surprised mm-hmm. at what people will say in the course of an interview at times, or what people will own up to, or the questions they will ask that are sort of a tell that age is a problem. Mm-hmm. And certainly if that sort of thing presents itself, maybe there's a hope. Maybe there's a toehold that a good lawyer can work with creatively.
503-231-8187 if you want to join the conversation. We're down to the last 15 minutes. And Rebecca, you look like you wanted to say something.
Well, I did just want to talk a little bit about barriers to employment that we're seeing more and more, partly due to the economy and partly just employer practices that have gotten more frequent, and that your call brought that up to me. One is discrimination against the unemployed. Mm. So major corporations that are advertising, we will not hire anyone who is already unemployed. And that has a huge impact on mainly older workers and people of color. Right. The other one that my organization works on is that, you know, 65 million of us have a criminal record in this country, and it's becoming very, very common for employers to ask on your application whether you have a criminal record and automatically disqualify you from even an interview if you have a criminal record.
Right.
And there's been some work around that, also falling heavily on communities of color, and there's been a real movement around the country to do what we call ban the box, mm-hmm. take that box off of the application. Mm-hmm. And that movement is really kind of, I think, reaching a tipping point. We have, I think, 17 states now that have passed some form of ban the box. I think it's increasingly important to all of us because criminal records are so common nowadays.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I know that governments in Oregon have banned the box. Mm-hmm. And I won't even say that it's all governments. I know Multnomah County, the city of Portland, maybe the state of Oregon. I don't know. Right. Mm-hmm. We haven't moved it. The ball much mm-hmm. in Oregon, and I know that there's been efforts around banning the box, but it's actually been focused on public mm-hmm. Agencies as compared to private sector employers. And so is the movement moving with private sector employers? Is that who you were referring to?
Both public and private. Okay. There's a growing number of jurisdictions, and I can't name them off the top of my head, that are banning the box for private employers as well. And some private employers that have taken it upon themselves to ban mm-hmm. the box as well.
Well, that's encouraging. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some legislative concepts.
One of the things I mentioned was that it's very difficult once you actually go through all the hoops and win a judgment, now supposedly a court or BOLI has determined that you're owed X thousand dollars.
Right.
And so to the layperson, that means, oh, I get paid.
Right, right.
Well, you get paid if the employer wants to pay you, but if not, then what you have to do is you have to find assets of the employer, that'd be, you know, money or something else that you can get your hand on to sell to be able to collect your judgment.
Really?
That's true.
Wait, the person who didn't get paid has to go and find assets of the employer that didn't pay them?
Yes.
And it's just the pay that they didn't get paid that they get? So there's no punitive damages? There's no...
Usually at that point, there will also be some penalty damages mm-hmm. that are added into it, and mm-hmm. perhaps attorney's fees that right. are added into it. But you still have that same fundamental problem is that what you have now is a nice piece of paper that you can put in a frame and put on the
that says you were
wall
right, right?
that
right.
makes you feel better or worse or I don't know what. But unless you can find something that you can send the sheriff out to get or send the sheriff out to take and sell, you don't get paid yet. And
that's appalling. Can I just say that? That is appalling.
Yeah, it is.
That's Oregon law?
That is Oregon law.
That's law really everywhere.
That very rarely am I surprised on this program, but let me just say that I'm appalled to hear that. So no wonder, you know, it's just like the police. No, people don't complain because the police investigate themselves. Yeah. This is the exact same kind of situation.
We've done some research with respect to claims that have gone through BOLI.
Right.
And on those claims, after BOLI has determined that money is due, I don't remember the figure exactly, but it's in the 30s of 30% that the employer actually ever winds up paying the judgment.
Okay, listeners, I am speechless. We're going back to the phone line right now. Hello, Wayne. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to follow on the heels of that comment about if you have a criminal record. And it appalls me in our country, in this state, that at some point you're never made whole.
Exactly.
If you go through the court system and right. you do what the courts tell you you should do, then to me, logically, at some point, a person should be made whole, and that would probably allow a lot of these young people to get jobs.
Exactly.
And it would just be such a boon to the economy. But to put someone through that system and then say, oh, and by the way, right. you will never be made whole.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. And in fact, in Oregon, we give people $50 and a bus ticket back to their home county. We say if you need alcohol and drug treatment, go get it. You need to get a job. You need to pay your back child support. You need to pay your back court costs. And by the way, stay out of trouble.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and get a job. Get a job. Right?
Is there a pardons board in Oregon? Like, can someone apply for a pardon to have their records sealed?
Or? Yes, they can. Yes, they can. The process is actually listed online. There is an organization that I don't like to recommend that's called Clean Slate that has a website. On that website, they actually have the document that you can use yourself. I would not encourage you to go through Clean Slate, yeah. but I would encourage you to get the information and then file it yourself. Mm-hmm. And
you
so
know,
there's
I
some
think
crimes.
A lot of people don't know
that. Oh, most people don't know that. Most people don't know that people, the day they get out, can vote in Oregon, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that people don't know. But
I also think that a good starting point would be that for most records, because the police have all the information they need.
Yes.
If you were to say every 5 years one of your offenses can roll away.
Right.
Then, you know, for most people in 5 years, and I don't mean every crime. I know some people will call in and say, well, what about murderers? And, well, you can't do it for everyone. But,
right.
but for most crimes, I think there is no reason why you couldn't be restored to whole after 5 years or something.
There's
like
actually
that.
Research that shows that I think it's 5 years. It might be 6 years. I can't remember. But any event, at some point, after someone with a felony conviction has spent that amount of time, I can't remember if it's 5 or 6 years, without reoffending, that they are no more likely to reoffend than anyone in the general population.
Right.
I mean, obviously, some employers have some legitimate concerns about some aspects of a criminal record, but at right. some point, right. if you clean up and do right and don't
Well, remember, we changed the Constitution in Oregon. We used to be about rehabilitation, but now we're about punishment and containment. And so when Oregon voters changed the Constitution, thanks to the likes of Kevin Mannix, and he put that junk on the ballot at the same time, ballot measure 11 and all his get tough on crime measures that that voters fell for.
Well, part of that is that if you have lots of statistics on the records, if you can go pull numbers, like I think in Oregon 17,000 people a year get DUIs or something. Then those statistics bolster those ideas. If you start rolling those numbers back, then all of a sudden we are what we are as a safe society.
Well, I mean, you know, the police don't make money unless they keep us in a place of fear.
Yeah.
And so it's all about spreading fear. Because if I can tell you that I'm afraid of you, if I can tell you that felons are just scary people, then nobody wants to be around a felon, right? The same is true for people of color. And the police, they have full-time people that do press release all day long to scare the community into believing that high crime, people of color are killing people left and right, and that's what created what we have. I got a great book for you to read. You want to get madder than you are right now? You need to read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow.
I've read it.
Have you?
It's a fantastic book.
Then that explains why you're as angry as you are. Thank you for your call. You have a fabulous day. Keep telling.
And you as well.
Thank you. Keep speaking truth to power.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye now. I'm going to go back to the phone line, try to squeak in one more caller before we call it a day.
Hello.
Mitch. Hello, Mitch. Welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, I'm going to take this to the federal level from the state level for just one second.
Okay.
Because on the state level, you're not going to find any media, especially the so-called alternative media, like the weekly papers.
Oh, I was going to say like us?
No, the reason we don't have an alternative press is because the weekly papers are businesses themselves.
Right.
And I remember living in San Francisco, and the greatest rhetorical defender of the working class was the San Francisco Bay Guardian, and they would never become a union shop themselves. There isn't the freedom to discuss this sort of thing. And then when you try and educate people on at-will employment, you cannot get one person in government to show numbers that since Oregon became an at-will employer, the rate of jobs created
and the wages
improved.
Jobs
that was the deal with the devil that was made.
That's right. So more jobs.
So few employment opportunities that you have to create these incentives. But there's never any measurement as to whether the incentives work or not. And so
year in, year out,
and don't expect the panel shows on OPB to bring this up because they have loads of marketplace shows. They don't have one on labor.
You know, you are absolutely right. We're all in total agreement, and I'm going to have to cut you off because the program's almost over. I have to say goodbye to my guest. Thank you so much for your call. So, Rebecca, if people want more information about the National Employment Law Project, is there a website they can go to? Of course, I'm going to list it later, but you want to say it?
Of course there is. It's www.nelp.org.
Excellent. And Michael, the same with the Northwest Workers Justice Project?
Our website is www.nwjp, like Northwest Workers Justice Project.org. And there's also actually a page on Ralph.
Well, we're going to list that all on the website, on the Voices from the Edge website. I'm Joanne Hardesty. We'll see you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Have a great day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Stand up for your rights.
And good morning. You are listening to the Mighty Boo, KBOO Portland. 1 minute before 9 o'clock. It is a Thursday morning, and coming up in a half hour at 9:30, we'll hear Fight the Empire. Today, host Per Fogering has guest journalist and author Norman Solomon, author of an article entitled, If Obama Orders the CIA to Kill a U.S. Citizen, Amazon Will Be a Partner in the Assassination. He contends that our new improved surveillance state continues to merge with the warfare state. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with cutting-edge news, views, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15, you can hear Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's Between the Covers with host David Naiman. Today's guest is Chang Ray Lee, author of the new dystopian novel On Such a Full Sea. That's all coming up this morning on KBOO. Coming up next, though, it's Teresa Mitchell with Press Watch. Get all the news you're not supposed to know, that is. Next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle Productions presentation of Medicarefully Fabulous. This courageous new work is a series of hopeful, inspiring, moving, hilarious, and extremely personal stories brought to you by Wendy Westerwell. Medicarefully Fabulous will run Thursday through Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. at The Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard until March 2nd. More information about this event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Won't you join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you are not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. Well, I'll pick up a local chain daily if this is one of the days that it publishes. I guess, come to think of it, it's not a chain daily anymore. It's just a chain paper. But it has the latest on the Jim Crow drug war. It's not calling it that. But if you crunch the numbers that seem somewhat more innocuous, if you don't put them quite this way, African-Americans in Portland. Hi, African-Americans in Portland. You're twice as likely to be stopped by police while driving. I know that comes as a shock to you. You're three times as likely to be stopped while walking, and you're four times as likely to be searched or patted down. Yep, the local chain is onto that. So you can read all about it. And latest from Fukushima, 100 metric tons of water leaked from Fukushima Daiichi this week. Look it up on a search engine. The water is so radioactive that, let's say I got a liter of this water, not a metric ton, but a liter, and set it next to your bed, well, by the end of the week, you'd be dead. TEPCO says, don't worry, must be okay. The United States is once again aligning itself with violent anti-Semitic thugs. Ukraine's long Kristallnacht is in the headlines right now as helmeted street gangs smash their way through police and anyone who opposes them, wielding iron bars, great big sticks, cobblestones, pistols. You know, just like Occupy did. Oh, wait. Occupy didn't do anything like that. Occupy was peaceful. Quoting the International Committee of the Fourth International and WSWS.org, the fact that Berlin and Washington are prepared to exploit the services of paramilitary fascist gangs for its own purposes exposes the official propaganda, which states that what is issue in Ukraine is the rule of law and democracy. In fact, the aim is to replace the regime of Yanukovych with one that will distance itself from Russia, subordinate itself to the European Union, and impose brutal austerity policies on the Ukrainian working class. Departing from the text, now, one of the things they say about Yanukovych is that he is terribly, terribly corrupt. For example, he's been giving tens of billions every month to the same banksters who ripped off the mortgage industry and crashed the economy. Oh, wait, that's Obama. Sorry, I got the wrong corrupt leader. So returning to what WSWS.com writes, .org, this is also the aim of the opposition led by Klitschko, Yatsenyuk, and Oleh Tyanibok, whose Svoboda Party, remember that one. That was that of those unfamiliar words in English, Svoboda is the one to remember. Svoboda Party means freedom. Sure it does. Openly celebrates the Nazi collaborator Stepan Bandera and espouses anti-Semitism and racism. More on that in a minute. Oh, hell yeah. They espouse anti-Semitism, not just a little bit. The battle for Ukraine, writes WSWS.org, is part of efforts by the U.S. and the European powers to incorporate all of Eastern Europe into their sphere of influence and isolate Russia. This process began with the restoration of capitalism, continued with the incorporation of former Eastern Bloc countries and the Baltic states into NATO and the European Union, and is now to be extended to large parts of the former Soviet Union. Ukraine, with its network of energy pipelines. Did someone say oil? Someone say gas? Strategically important military bases and heavy industry is a major target of European and American imperialism. On two occasions in the last century, in 1918 and 1941, German imperialism invaded Ukraine. In World War II, Hitler's armies massacred millions of Ukrainians. And some Ukrainians